like LGBT. And typically, I think part of what this does is that it trains us as a culture, and it trains us even as Christians to assume that questions around issues of how do we interact with gay and lesbian Christians, how do we interact with gay and lesbian persons in general in our culture, how do we think about ministry questions, relational questions, public policy questions connected with gay and lesbian people. How is that similar or different from transgender persons? And I sometimes think that just putting it all, and you know, we're not even going to talk about questions of bisexuality right now. But I think of putting these all together sometimes is unnecessarily generalizing. All right, so as you think about this, how are these issues similar to each other or different from? How are these persons similar to different from? Anybody?
Yeah. I can kind of think of one example that comes to mind when I'm thinking about this. I have a friend who, I'm not even 100% sure like how to explain the situation because I like am very confused. But it's two girls were born female, now identify as male, and they're a couple, so they're gay. But like, I guess there's like there's such a disconnect between who you're attracted to and then who you identify as. Like,
yeah.
I feel like that's the big like transgender, gay, lesbian. There isn't like the transgender person is not attracted to the same sex.
Yeah.
Like, cause
yeah.
They have become different sex.
Yeah. 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 So even how to classify that, if, you know, to ask somebody. I mean, and this is. You know, when you think about some of these conversations, when the, you know, sort of the question is, so would you, if you have a situation, there are situations like this where even you have a couple that gets married, a man and a woman, and then one of them transitions. So this past summer, I read a memoir called She's Not There about a man who transitioned to female in the context of, you know, a marriage that he'd been in for 20 years. So. He, you know, how him and his spouse understand themselves is not, you can't quite as easily just say, well, this is just a same-sex relationship. It's not quite that simple in terms of how they would identify and how they would think about this. One way that I think there's a difference is simply, I think when you look at I think about this from a biblical, theological perspective. When you're talking about same-sex sexual activity, I think that's something that's clearly addressed in Scripture. What I'm not so sure of, and this is where I'd be interested to hear your perspective on that, when I think about the cluster of issues relating to transgender questions, these aren't the same. But I think a lot of times, Christians and others assume that once they address same-sex sexual activity, that they've now dealt with transgender issues. Maybe partly because, again, the way that our culture kind of says LGBT, all as though this is all just one thing that we're talking about, and it's not quite that simple, I think. And so, from my perspective, as complex as it is biblically and theologically to address same-sex relationships, I think it's maybe more complex because we have less direct, if any, direct biblical material that gives kind of clear-cut instructions, right? We still obviously have the biblical texts that talk about God creating us as male and female. But then think about, you know, the example I mentioned earlier of not only intersex people, but of these, you know, exceptional cases where people sort of naturally transition at puberty from female to male, and what that means, like, how do you theologically and pastorally deal with those
situations. I think that's complicated.
I think one of my one of the biggest struggles I think I have for overcoming. You hear a lot of arguments against transgender on the basis of, well, they were born with these, they were born male, they were born female, these genitals and whatnot, and God doesn't make any mistakes creating. But then you have people who are born with missing limbs, and you have people born with other mental disorders that are clearly wrong.
Yeah.
As well as, so how do you how can you make a definitive case?
Yeah.
For one or the other.
Yeah. And this, I think, is the crucial question that we get at here is, how do we classify this? How do we think about this? What framework are we going to use to do this? And I should mention, if I don't answer all your questions today, you can talk with Yosef and Marissa, because they read this whole book, read their book reviews. You're going to give you more
insight there.
Okay, but this is the key question. When we talk about gender dysphoria, and does everybody know what, if I use the term DSM, we're on DSM-5 now, right? Everybody knows what this is? Actually, I don't, what does this stand for? Okay, whatever, we all know what it is. Okay, DSM, the right, this is essentially the diagnostic. I'm assuming this stands for diagnostic.
Something.
All right. But in DSM-5, there's actually been a switch, because it used to use the term in DSM-4. I know what the last part means. It's which volume it is. Latest edition. In edition 5, it switched from using the term gender identity disorder to gender dysphoria. In part I think in part to avoid the stigma from talking about a person as disordered, and wanting to move away from that to this language of gender dysphoria, people whose gender at birth is contrary to the one that they identify with. And this question that Yosef raises is a question of, how do we classify somebody who says, this is my experience? Does this get classified as sin? I want to be clear here, not just people saying this is a general result of the fall, because I think Yarhouse says there's certainly an element of that at play when we think about all the things that can and do go wrong in human life. So not just sin in terms of broad effects of the fall, but how do we understand this in terms of personal conscious willing to act a certain way or to take this on yourself? So if somebody says, I feel this way, to say, well, that's your own sin problem. The disability framework, this would fit more with what Yosef mentioned in terms of saying, look, when we think about the DSM-5, typically when we're making these diagnoses, we recognize that a lot of the things in here are in some sense things that happen to a person because of biology or because of environmental circumstances, that these are things that may, sometimes in the DSM-5, there's a level of personal conscious involvement here, but the framework of disability says something has gone wrong here that is beyond this person's control. So when we engage and when we think about interacting with transgender persons from this perspective, it is, as though somebody, we might think of a physical deformity as being more obvious. Now, there are a lot of people, though, within the transgender community who would not appreciate the disability framework, because it emphasizes, in essence, it says basically you're broken, you've gone wrong, something's wrong with you. Diversity framework focuses more on, as Yarhouse talks about, the diversity framework focuses more on, this is who I am, this is part of my identity, this is where, something like the gender-bred person says, oh, okay, this helps me understand myself. There's a category for people like me. And so it's not just that there's this basic category of males who are attracted to females and females who are attracted to males, and everybody else is just, you know, has a disability or is out of bounds or is weird or strange or wrong, but says that sexuality, think back to our discussion with Wesley Hill, that maybe sexuality is more like ethnicity in terms of saying, well, now I can identify because I recognize that there are all these different categories, not just two, and this resonates with me. This explains why I think and feel like I do, and this connects up with how I operate. What are the strengths and weaknesses of these categories? That's a real question. As you think about these three categories, what value do they bring to looking at this discussion? Do these help you? Yeah, Yosef.
I think what Yarhouse says is that definitely the first perspective, the integrity framework. I don't know if that's on the next page.
Yeah, this
framework.
Yeah.
It's all about, it's important because we still want to uphold God's creating us male and female.
Yeah.
And women and the biblical structure behind it. But, I mean, he mentioned it's been so misused, so terrifying against people that have alienated them from church, have alienated and condemned, call it sin, other things they can't really control. Largely, I think, is what his conclusion is about that perspective. And the opposite side, the diversity framework highlights the importance of community. Largely, he does categorize this into a stronger and a weaker one. He does deal mostly with the weaker, which claims that we should all at least recognize the community and the aspect and the need for belonging, the need for acceptance, and so on, which I think is what we need to balance in this questions in our churches in general when it comes to LGBT questions. In the first place, and then strength. But then again, I mean, it's can easily be so overdone that that's all that matters, and let's disregard scripture. So he cautions against that. And then the disability framework just highlight that in a way to says nothing that they can control about this largely. I mean, it shows that it takes away, removes it as a sin issue.
And as he talked about this, if you pick up this on this in the reading, he says, with the diversity framework, that you have a couple of different perspectives here. You can have the strong perspective, which in some ways tries to completely... I feel like this isn't working as well as I would like it. Why are these markers never up to my standards? That's it. I'm getting a new marker every day out of the supply closet. This has to work. So the strong diversity perspective would essentially completely deconstruct any notion of male and female. And this was a perspective you got from the one person in the video who basically says this is all a social construct. This is just invented to sell, you know, male and female deodorants and stuff like that, which I will tell you, that is not true. Because one time I ran out of... Anyway. My wife's deodorant is not due. It says it's strong enough for a man, made for a woman, but that is not. That is not true. But what's interesting about this perspective, okay, is that it's going to deconstruct really any sense of male and female, but then it leads you to this point where you do have what in the world?
Hey, where's the trash?
Buckets.
All right, I gotta find one more. But this time is done. It's been a while since I beat up on students in the basketball court, so I'm a little out of shape. When we think about how this works, what this can easily lead to is really what you have is, if you can say it this way, in the name of complete diversity, you have in some sense a completely individually defined view of sexuality. So it's whatever you say you are, whatever you feel like you are. Unfortunately, you can only kind of work with that for so long, because you as an individual are always operating within a culture that has certain expectations. And so in some ways, this is actually less diverse because it says there is, you know, one rule, and that is everyone defines themselves individually. And that applies absolutely across the board. But so you have this, the strong view of diversity ends up deconstructing any of this, which I think Yarhouse says is a problem. But you do have the weak form of diversity that, as Yosef mentions, underscores the need for community and belonging and recognizing that there is a place, that you have a place, that there is a place where you can fit in, there is a place where you can connect, and that this is valuable. And so the way that he kind of graphs this, he says, in terms of the transgender community as a whole, typically the diversity framework is what they use. And that this is common in how people approach this, that they would see your gender identity simply as being a manifestation of human diversity, just like ethnicity or other things like that. Even if you take the human diversity class here at Kuiper, part of what you look at is ethnic or racial diversity, and part of what you look at is sexual diversity. Uses this kind of framework. He says the conservative religious script typically very much emphasizes the integrity framework, so that it says God has created us male and female. These others, you know, maybe this is generous, I think, for some people, these don't even impinge on this at all. Depending on how nuanced folks' view are, but he's at least saying there's this possibility out there. I think this would be Yarhouse's own model, would be to say that there are strengths in each of these. I think he would say there is, from a Christian perspective, you can't just get rid of this integrity framework, that this is foundational to who we are, male and female. At the same time, I think this is where he uses the disability framework to say, how does the fall affect all of us? And affect all of us in a way that precedes our own sin, that we are born into a world that's broken in terms of our wills, but even in terms of our bodies, in terms of our cultures, in terms of how we think about gender. And so this is where, you know, going back to my question about rhetorical value, I think Yarhouse says the disability framework does have a rhetorical value, especially for folks who come from a very conservative religious perspective, to say, look, we should treat this not as simply a matter of people consciously and desiring to, you know, to just live a life of rampant sin, but as something that's gone wrong in some way, however we define and talk about that, as a result of the fall. And so saying this is important, and saying, using the diversity framework, that people who would identify as transgender need a place to belong, that they need a place to connect, and typically they don't find that in the church. Typically they have to look to the broader transgender community or the LGBT community as a whole to find that. And so for us to think about what does it mean for us to operate as the church. So we'll come back to this in just a minute. I think a further issue here is how we think about guilt versus shame. And I think this is guilt and shame. I think this is true when you're dealing with any sexual issue, but especially when we think about issues of same-sex orientation or from people who have who are either questioning or who are firmly entrenched in a gender identity that's different from their birth gender. I think the difference here is that guilt says, I have done wrong, versus shame, which says, I am wrong. Right? Get the distinction there, that I have done wrong focuses on the fact that I do things, right, that are not right. I am wrong goes to, in some sense, the core of my identity, the core of who I am. And this is where, as Yarhouse thinks about shame, he says, you know, this is something that is a real, that's a real danger because of how churches talk about, I think well-meaningly, but how they talk about the integrity framework. You take that and then you set that on top of maybe a broader culture that has more rigid male-female views of what that means. And it puts you in a potentially very difficult place for those who feel that by no choice of their own, that there's something that doesn't align here. Especially when you look at, in some of the research that Yarhouse and others have done, typically people talk about their first kind of conscious awareness of the fact that something is misaligned here, being at age six, right? So you think about a six-year-old, right? How does a six-year-old deal with that? I mean, I think about that in terms of my own kids who are kind of right in that age range. Having the sense that something's not right, and when you're in a community that maybe strongly underscores this and sees kind of any kind of divergence as being a manifestation of sin, that then, you know, for somebody who is a six-year-old not consciously making these things, for them to wrestle with that, it's not surprising that this can be an opportunity for all kinds of things to enter into the picture in terms of struggles with other things, whether it's depression or eating disorders or anger and acting out and violence, because there's just this sense of incongruity. And oftentimes, I think when we look theologically, I think we rightly focus on the solution to our guilt, you know, to the wrong things that we've done, to the fact that we stand convicted because of the wrong things we've done. The solution to the guilt, I think, is the cross of Christ. That we emphasize that Jesus took all of our sin, that we are justified, that God pronounces Christ guilty because he takes our guilt upon himself, and we receive his innocence. But I think a lot of times on a deeper spiritual and psychological level, we don't realize that solving guilt may not necessarily address shame. Right? That there's still this sense that, right, because guilt is about what I've done wrong, shame in some sense goes deeper, that there's something fundamentally wrong with who I am at my core. And this is where even somebody like John Calvin, right, who's speaking to me from Eddie's t-shirt, I should just have you come up here and stand here while I, you know, even Calvin says, look, we need to recognize the fact that what's essential to our humanness is that we are created good creatures of God. That's how he made us in the beginning. And that sin is, now this is a little bit of a technical philosophical terms, sin is accidental. Not accidental in the sense of like, oops, I'm really clumsy and I tripped again, that was an accident. But accident in the sense that this is the core of who we are. This is an unnecessary addition or distortion of what we are. And so even somebody like Calvin says, look, at the core, God created us as these good creatures. And I think part of what shame does is shame really puts a question mark at the heart of this goodness and says, now, like, there's something about me in my essence that is wrong. And so I think because of this, there's a difference in how guilt and shame moves. I think guilt moves more toward community. Guilt moves, I think, toward a sense of confession of what's been done wrong and a release from that, whereas I think shame typically moves away from community. That shame fuels hiding because it says, you know, if you really knew who I was, you would not love me. You'd say, you're not good enough. There's something about me at my core that would repel you from me. And so I think that's why you see when people are moving away from community, when they go into hiding, that you do see it then, you know, coming out in all kinds of troublesome ways for themselves and for others. That there's not a sense I can go to somebody and say, I'm a person who is attracted to people of the same sex. And I can tell you that without feeling like, you know, at the essence of who I am, there's just badness and shame. Or I can tell you that, yeah, I was, people think I'm a man, but I feel fundamentally like a woman. I think people hesitate with that because of the way that shame works. And I don't know about your experience in the church, but some churches are better at this than others, but I think we often very much struggle with this because we want to say, we have it all together. And you know, it's one of these weird things where you would think, especially if you're a Calvinist, that people would be just like, yeah, totally depraved. Here it is, folks. Like, that's who I am. But instead, it's not. There's a sense, I think, of even in our churches of hiding. Yeah, Danny.
Sorry. I think that, especially, I don't know, I think this framework, the idea here could be applied to the way churches pastorally think about all mental illnesses as well. Because I think that there's definitely an issue with the way churches handle mental illness as a whole. And I think the guilt versus the shame could be a big key to understanding that. I don't know. That's just a thought that I have.
Yeah. That in terms of saying that people feel a sense of shame about that as well, this is something that you have to kind of cover or
yeah,
or
that hide. I am wrong instead of that I am wrong, which is interesting.
Yeah, and it even makes me think, you know, to go back to some of the previous slides and the frameworks, you know, part of what I wonder, even when you think about the questions of mental health, if the church still has some kind of framework of like, that we think about sin before we think about disability. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, somebody's struggling with depression. Well, that's their fault because they need to pray more or trust God more, as opposed to saying, like, you know, well, you know, you have cancer. Well, you just need to pray more and trust God more. Right? Of saying, like, that there is. Now, I think those things are intertwined. This is part of why I appreciate what Yarhouse says here, is because it does say at different points one of those frameworks may be more central than the others. But I think that's a good insight to connect this to mental health as well, and thinking about how the church should deal with this. So one of the things that Yarhouse brings out later in his book is that there are these different models of how we think about the church. And think about where your own experience of the church fits here. He says, most traditional evangelical churches follow this first model. The first thing you do is behave, right? Get your act together, act a certain way, and then you believe. And then once you've done those things, there's a sense of belonging. And so there's this emphasis on behavioral conformity, and then sort of similar, same beliefs, and then a sense of belonging. And he says, you know, when you think about this traditional model, it's actually very conditional, right? It says we'll love you and we'll treat you as a member of our community if you act in a certain way, if you act in the right way. And I think, I mean, even think about the order here. This would not fit with what most churches say they believe, especially Protestant churches would say, well, what do you have? Faith. And works that then grow out of that faith. The point is not, well, if your works righteousness measures up, then congratulations, you're part of the community. And so he says this second model here is what you might call, well, what he calls a more missional model. This says the focus is first on a sense of connection and belonging, that you are connected to the community, not simply because you behave like the community, or even maybe first and foremost because you believe like the community, but there's a sense of relational connection here that is foundational. And so I haven't taken the relational ministry class here, but I imagine that this kind of thing would resonate and say, the first thing you do is not, especially think about it in terms of youth ministry, all you can behave yourselves exactly like you're supposed to. Then you believe the right things, and then you'll belong, right? The point is, how do you first connect with people and build relationships, I think individually and as a church, and move them further in this direction? I mean, clearly when you look at the New Testament church, there was some sense in which, I think, especially in particular the believing, right, happens before the beheading. Right, read 1 Corinthians. Right, the church of Corinth certainly belonged together and believed something, but they had some behavioral issues. And I think maybe if we're honest with ourselves, we all kind of have some behavioral issues. But this model makes us, like say, we got to put on the right face so that we can kind of all stay together.
What was your reasoning behind switching away from become on the second scale there rather than and putting behave there instead?
Well, yeah, because Jarhouse says become here.
Yeah.
Well, I think you could probably do either. I just felt like for the sake of...
easy.
Yeah, in terms of the words, I thought it made more sense to keep them all together. But I think Jarhouse's point is that I think we never all behave perfectly. There's always a sense of sanctification. Is that right? That's what he says, right, in terms of that's why he puts become?
So?
Okay.
The Z is a process.
Yeah. And so I think either way I would capture it because I don't want to downplay the reality of sanctification, that there is meant to be this you know, behavior that is different when we think about how this works and how this functions. And in this, I think the important thing to remember here, think back to Shaw, what's the goal? The goal is Christ-likeness, and Shaw says it in terms of, it's not heterosexuality. When we think about gender dysphoria, you could say, you know, the goal is Christ-likeness. It's not that there's this perfect congruence between your biological sex and your gender identity. And that it very well may be the case that this sense of gender dysphoria is never going to go away. And that in some sense that's not necessarily the goal. And so I think even with this topic, to keep our focus in the same proper direction. Let me stop there for a minute. Questions or comments in terms of these different models? Where do you see your own church in terms of these models, the first or the second? Or churches in general? Yeah.
Just kind of a thought that, like, remembering back to when I did take relational ministry, and a problem that we see in a lot of youth groups is that when we teach lessons to our youth groups, they're generally based off of topics from, like, the New Testament of we should do this, we should act in this way, we should do this, and it's all kind of focusing on behavior and really not so much helping them to really grow and develop that relationship with Christ before, like, there's reasoning to behave that way.
Yeah.
Like, we're saying, all right, if you're a Christian, like, you're coming to youth group, church, then you should do X, Y, and Z, instead of helping them understand, like, who God is and what that means for them and how that then changes the way that you behave.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a sense of, understanding that identity in Christ and seeing that as the foundation for, you know, all of this is going to flow from. And that's tricky. I think it's difficult with youth and with adults because there is a certain sense in which you want to say, like, and then here's how you live that out. But yeah, I think especially with kids, I feel this with my own kids. I want to emphasize do the right thing. But I even more want to emphasize, like, have a transformed heart. Like that's where that is. I remember last summer I got into a discussion about this with somebody in one of my in a class that I took on liturgy and worship, where one of the discussions right now is between these two different models. You know, this model says everybody who's there for the Lord's Supper just partake, because the important thing is belonging. As opposed to, you know, that's what we want people to feel, that's what we want to see and connect. So it's kind of a tangential issue, but I was a little bit uncomfortable pushing it that far in terms of saying, like, well, you are saying something when you participate in this meal, and it's not, like, we want you to feel welcome, that's why we maybe, you know, have the potluck, right, belong in the potluck time. But yeah, can I get a witness for potlucks? That's good. Yeah, Derek.
When I went to Haiti this past summer, the churches there, the Christians there, and even the non-Christians, everyone in Haiti followed the first model. And what I mean by that is, in Haiti, you have to be able to purchase and provide nice clothes to, in order to go to church. You need to have your life together in order to go to church. You can't be poor, you can't be struggling, your house can't be a mess, or like it couldn't be destroyed, even if it was like an earthquake or anything that destroyed it. If your life isn't together, you don't have, almost like it's a right that you don't have to go to church.
Yeah.
And we found that out by talking to some of the Haitians. Just we'd ask them, you know, do you go to church? No, yes. Yeah. Then we asked them what their biggest deterrent for that was. But we also asked like the pastors there, and that's what they were saying.
So very much focused on keeping up appearances and making sure you have everything kind of together.
Yeah.
As an entrance requirement for participation.
Yeah, and the pastors, a lot of the pastors that we talked to were deeply saddened by this, but their congregations weren't.
Hmm.
Their congregations didn't, you know, I don't know if there was a disconnect from what the pastor was preaching and what the congregation was hearing, or if they didn't talk about that.
Yeah.
Or what, because in talking to the pastors, they all were heartbroken about this. But in talking to the congregation, they're all like, yeah, this makes sense. You have to be able to provide nice clothes. Yeah. You're going to God's house.
Yeah.
You know, you have to provide nice clothes. You have to, we went to a church where they met under some posts and like branches over top, just covering. And they were, when we came to their church, they were humiliated. Because
they thought it should be better? Or
yeah, they had these plans to make this thing, and for them it's to have a concrete foundation.
Yeah.
To have walls, to have a ceiling. And if they didn't have that, it wasn't good enough for God. And I love and respect that they have this love and this desire to respect God as best they can.
Yeah.
But
it seems like it takes it too far.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it, you know what you're saying, you know, it reminds me that when I think about the flip side here, the flip side of shame, I think, is pride. And, I mean, that's one way of hiding the shame. And it's a way of saying, even here, we say, I am good, but I'm a good creature of God. You know, that who I am, in that sense, depends on God. Pride, in some sense, says, I am good, full stop, right? Just in and of myself, apart from any kind of relationship with God. So, I think it's interesting to think about how that shame and that pride serve as these mirror images of each other. And I wonder then, too, for a lot of people, being able to classify one group of people as like, man, these are bad people, really helps with my own pride status. That I can identify this group of people who are just sort of wrong in and of themselves and say, I'm not like that, and so I don't fit into that. Just a couple of the things I want to mention in terms of theological perspective, and then a few questions. One thing I found interesting, Yarhouse mentions this at a couple points, is when we think about gender dysphoria, again, there's sometimes this tendency to think about it as a disability, but what about thinking of it in terms of gender fullness? That there's a sense in which a person experiences something of, you know, both male and femaleness, in one person. And there's I've even heard people make mention of this with reference to discussions of intersex people or other things like that. But to say that maybe there's some kind of perspective here that, that says there's a unique insight that somebody who struggles with gender dysphoria may have in terms of their perspective and experience. So that's one thing to think about. Becca, were you going to chime in or Taylor?
No.
Taylor?
Okay. I guess, I mean, some of that has merit, but that could be valuable. But I guess one problem I have with that is that it makes people more independent as opposed to interdependent. Because I think there's value in struggling through and figuring out that other person's perspective instead of just automatically knowing it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't even think it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The problem is just even that exists on a spectrum in the first place.
Yeah.
That no one experiences that. No one experiences the same gender dysphoria the same as another one.
Yeah.
And however that is measured, gender fullness, I'm sure very few people have even described anything like that at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
That he's interviewed, because it's such a small. Do you remember the number off the top of your head? How many large percentage is it?
I don't.
Is it 0.001 or something like that? 0.01?
Yeah, it's pretty small.
It's really small.
Yeah, yeah. So this was one, but I just thought this is at least an interesting notion. And one of the things that was fascinating, again, reading this memoir that I read last summer, when the person went through the process of medically transitioning, it was interesting to talk about how their perspective on life changed as they moved from male to female, and as they received different shots of hormones and other things like that, how their experience of the world around them very much changed because of that. It was just interesting to read. I'm not sure exactly what to do with it, but it was interesting to think about how this person was saying, man, what I'm experiencing as a woman in terms of how she talked about now, there's a sense of the way that she described it was, as a man, there's kind of a barrier between you and the world. Like, stuff kind of hits you and bounces off in a way that it didn't once she fully transitioned. All right. I'm taking her word for it. But it was just interesting to hear about this spectrum that she experienced. The other thing that Yarhouse points out is that there is an element of redemptive suffering here, that this is something that I think is in common with Yarhouse and Shaw, is that they both say suffering is not meaningless. Suffering is not just something to be avoided at any cost, but that even living with the tension and living with the reality of what this means is something that is potentially meaningful, but I think Yarhouse and Shaw again agree, you're only going to have this, I think you're only going to be able to see this as a positive thing if you are embedded in and connected to community. The idea of an individual suffering, isolated in shame, is not redemptive. And so there has to be a community and a place for people who are experiencing gender dysphoria. They have to be comfortable and able to talk about it with other Christians, with other friends, if it's going to be something like redemptive suffering. A few other questions that come up. We don't have a lot of time to address these, but I just want to put these on the table and then say just a couple of things about medical ethics here. One question is, how do different views of gender roles play into this discussion? For example, even in Piper and Grootheisen. And one of the questions that I do have is, I wonder if the more rigidly we kind of have gender stereotypes, I think part of what that does is say, like, well, you know, again, to use very rigid stereotypes, well, I like this thing that is feminine. Well, is it really feminine, or is it just that my culture has stereotyped it this way? Right? If, again, you can think about the example, is a boy playing with dolls, is that troubling? Right? Well, apparently not if they're G.I. Joe dolls. right? Or Star Wars dolls. Those are action figures. and so when you think about the way that sometimes our overly rigid gender stereotypes may just not be helpful here. Another question is, to what extent can Christians accept gender making as part of culture making? And to what extent should we resist it? And part of what I suggested, if you remember earlier on in the course, is that I do think there is a way that different cultures are going to shape and form gender to look different. And that even in terms of diversity of cultures and diversity of how those cultures look at gender or gender roles, that's not necessarily bad in and of itself. And to recognize that there is a role there to say there is a givenness of male and female, but in terms of how we think about masculinity or femininity, much of that is culturally produced, and that's okay. And that maybe part of what Christians do is even interact with and maybe push against some of the ways that those stereotypes are sometimes set up by our broader culture, and to be aware of this. And so how do you, but I think we have to walk this line of saying, there's a givenness here that you can't erase. But there's also flexibility in terms of how this might look in a variety of different contexts and cultures and cultural situations. This is a more practical question, more philosophical question, I think, to ask. If gender is completely socially constructed, as some people might say, again, as one of the folks on the video says, you know, what do we make of claims to feel different from the gender assigned at birth? You know, in other words, when people say, I was assigned, you know, as a male, even I have male genitalia, but I feel like a woman. What exactly are they saying? Are they saying that they feel like a woman as their culture would understand it? Or are they saying something deeper? You know, and usually I think there's this idea that they're saying something deeper, which, however you think about it, seems to suggest that there is this kind of givenness here. To say I'm a man, and I don't just feel like what a socially constructed 21st century North American woman feels like, but I just feel, I feel plain like a female, even though I was born male. So I think sometimes not all of the thinking, even within the broader LGBT movement, is always clear on this. And so this is just a question. How does our medical technology play into our culture's response to gender dysphoria? And I think the tendency here is, with some other things, including maybe infertility or contraception, the tendency is to seek a medical, scientific, technological solution to an issue that is probably more complex than that. And so one of the questions, especially that Christians wrestle with, is sex reassignment surgery. How do we think about the medical ethics here, especially to say, okay, there are doctors who are trained specifically to operate on the genitalia and reproductive organs in ways that are meant to correct something that's wrong there, right? Whether because of the effects of other diseases or because of birth defects or other things like that. This is where medical ethics, there's a difference between somebody undergoing a remedial procedure, it's correcting something that's gone wrong, versus an elective procedure that is not necessarily correcting something that's wrong. So again, even to think about something like cosmetic surgery, there are cosmetic surgeons who may perform facial reconstructive surgery because somebody has to have their jaw removed because of cancer or someone's burned. And so they do cosmetic surgery to restore something that has been damaged. That's different from somebody saying, like, well, I'm not perfectly satisfied with the shape or size of my nose, and so I want my doctor to fix the size of my nose. Those are two different things. And so one of the questions that's raised about this is, how do we think about sex reassignment surgery? And this is a comparison that Yarhouse quotes an author who makes this comparison and says, sex reassignment surgery is like liposuction for those suffering with anorexia. This is a bit of a controversial claim in our culture. But this is the full quote. This is from Paul McHugh. He says, The transgendered suffer a disorder of assumption like those in other disorders familiar to psychiatrists. With the transgendered, the disordered assumption is that the individual differs from what seems given in nature, namely one's maleness or femaleness. Other kinds of disordered assumptions are held by those who suffer from anorexia and bulimia nervosa, where the assumption that departs from physical reality is the belief by the dangerously thin that they are overweight. Okay, so you see the parallel he's drawing here, that there's a something in terms of self-image or self-understanding that doesn't actually fit with reality. And so what McHugh says is that he is the head of surgery, I think it's at John Hopkins Hospital, and says they've ceased to do sex reassignment surgery because in their medical opinion, it's not something that is addressing or that is worth addressing in this particular medical way, to this extent, to this extreme, where you're essentially trying to, you're essentially reconstructing somebody's genitals. Says this is not something that they're going to do. Now, part of this, you know, McHugh in this article talked about the fact that as they followed up with individuals who've done sex reassignment surgery, part of what they've seen is that typically it doesn't make a drastic difference in that person's life and in their experience. Now, part of this, I think, they suggest, is probably due to environmental factors. It's not, but I think the point is this, it's not as simple, if you're addressing gender dysphoria, it's never as simple as just have sex reassignment surgery and that's going to set everything right, because you still have family relationships, friendship relationships, all kinds of other questions that are still in play there. And so Yarhouse's advice here, he says, typically the least invasive solution is best. I think Yarhouse, as a you know, professional psychologist, says, I recognize people are all across the spectrum in terms of what their experience is, and withholding judgment in terms of if this person says this is what they need, I think he would tend to discourage going to this extreme. But he says this is, for some people, that is the path that they choose, and so the question that he approaches is more how do you walk with somebody through that, as opposed to let me just give you an abstract medical view of this. Joseph, are you going to chime in on this?
Now, I was just thinking about the perspective of going through sex assignment surgery. Those who don't know you might, then again, you can get results with hormonal treatment too, but they might perceive you as the gender you're trying to. I guess you could do that with clothes too, try to mask it, but at least society will perceive you maybe closer to what you yourself in your head identify to by going through some of this, and might cause less societal stress when you're out in the public.
Yeah.
At least.
Yeah.
So there is some value, but yeah, as you say, the relations and whatnot, it still doesn't take away them.
Yeah. And so it might be easier in terms of, you know, the person who, you know, maybe you couldn't identify him as transgender in the BuzzFeed video, that people are like, what? Right. Clearly, there's some sense in which if you didn't know him, you would just say, yeah, he's a man. So in that sense, it would ease some of those experiences, while at the same time, you know, it may not address some of the deeper questions there in terms of relationships and interconnections with others. One of my questions when I think about this topic as a whole, I know this is a lot to try to address in 3 minutes, but do students at Kuiper, or do students coming to Kuiper, perceive Kuiper as a safe place to think about these and things and talk about these things? Or, I mean, I think about, so this class is largely upperclassmen. I mean, I just wonder, you know, if you could tell freshmen coming into Kuiper, like, here's what you should think and here's what you should know about how to process some of these issues around sexual attraction, sexual identity, gender identity. I know that's it's a fairly heavy topic, but I just wonder, I don't know, from your perspective, how safe of a community is Kuiper to think and process these things?
Yeah. Seeing that as soon as someone walks the loop and everyone instantly knows about it, it's difficult to, everyone will know many of these things.
Yeah.
That you are able to confess. So I would see that as a potential hindrance in the way that you can be as as private necessarily as we would be at a bigger university where the people don't know who you are, but everyone, many people, I can't say everyone, but many people know almost everyone.
Yeah. Well, so you can't hide. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Or is it a, because I mean, it might be the opportunity. It might be the chance to say like, I can't hide this. And so potentially it could have the opportunity to be a place to process in the thing. You know, I just wonder how can we think about this myself? You know, how can we continue to communicate, whether it's to transgender persons or to gay and lesbian persons, you know, the love of God. And all of these things are important as we think about ministry. But to me, that stands as a central one, especially in a culture where for so long Christians have been perceived as just anti anything here. So how do we intentionally work at reversing our actions in terms of how people perceive the love of God in and through us? That's an ongoing question. All right, next time, this is the book. Read it.
No, not the whole thing.
But his chapter on affection is really good. It's going to give you great insight into...